God, I've been arguing with these guys for 2 hours. Battered down. I need at least 30 minutes there. What's your poser?
It's out in Christiansburg, right? It's on zero now.
Claim settlement. It's the 3rd of April, Wednesday. The time is 12:35. We have with us the following members of our committee. Representative Tabuda, Representative Gail Phillips, Representative DeMar, myself, Max Gruenberg. We've also been joined by Representative Mark Boyer. I'd like to welcome you. Today, we have a few committee announcements, which I'm going to keep to a very minimum here, and then we're going to go right in to hear the testimony of the Honorable Charles Kuhl, Alaska Attorney General, and we'd like to welcome him to the committee as well.
Thank you.
We appreciate his courtesy in participating with us. The members should have, first of all, a chronology of timeline on this committee that we discussed yesterday. This will be being developed. Also, drafts of two letters that are being sent by myself to Judge Holland, in one case, and to the federal government attorneys in the other case. I think they're pretty self-explanatory. We have also we've had an oil spill litigation chronology document and a meeting schedule document. We also have a part, and you'll be given the entire letter to Attorney General Thornburg from the Congress. It looks like we've only been given part of that, and you'll get the rest of that.
Just a signature page.
Oh, we're just missing the signature page. Okay, so that is the entire letter. I'd like the staff to make sure that we get the entire letter, please. You will be given very shortly a memorandum to Senator Eliason and myself. I guess you now have that. Concerning the authority of the governor and attorney general to enter into the Exxon Valdez settlement agreement. I think some of the members may not have that. We are in the process of duplicating that. We've also been joined by Representative Hudson. Before we start with Mr. Cole's testimony, are there any questions or comments from any members of the committee on anything? Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, do I understand that from previous testimony that the April 8th and 9th hearings before the House Interior Subcommittee, weren't those canceled?
That's correct.
Yes, they were.
Thank you.
The answer is yes, they were. Okay. Any other questions? If not, Mr. Cole, we'd like to welcome you today to our committee, and we would appreciate it if you would give us a brief overview of the agreements, the series of agreements, and the history of the negotiations. You've been given a list of what our questions were, and those are our particular areas of concern. I believe you have those. Please.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before this committee this afternoon. When the decision was made to include in the settlement agreement with Exxon the provision that, as a condition to the validity of the agreement, it was required to be approved by the Alaska legislature. The governor and I were well aware of the fact that the legislature would act responsibly in connection with its approval process, and that it would have questions about the agreement, and that we would be required to appear before the legislative committees and respond to those questions and any concerns which the legislature might have developed in connection with the process. So I'm pleased to appear here this afternoon, and I shall endeavor to respond to any questions which the legislature or any of the members of this body may direct toward me. Do I understand that you wanted a general overview of the process, or did you want to initially begin to address the questions which have been furnished to me?
I'd like an overview of the process that you went through, a brief background, so that the members of this committee understand how this all occurred and the background, since we're dealing with a series of contracts that we're negotiating.
I hadn't prepared to respond to that question here this afternoon, and I didn't know that I would be asked yet, but nonetheless...
Well, if you don't feel comfortable, we can take that... You'll be back again, we can take that the next time.
Well, maybe we can just say this fundamentally. So if it's a little disorganized, please bear with me. You will recall, as I previously said, that not long after Governor Hickel was inaugurated and I was appointed as Attorney General, I received a telephone call from Assistant Attorney General Richard B. Stewart, during which he suggested the desirability of meeting with me and any of the representatives who had been working on behalf of the state in connection with the oil spill litigation to discuss the oil spill issues. And in response to his telephone call, we met in Seattle. I think it was on December 29. It was Friday before the New Year's holiday in Seattle. Present at the meeting were George Van Cleve, Deputy Attorney General, Lands and Resources, the United States Department of Justice. Of course, Mr. Stewart, Assistant Attorney General, Lands and Resources, Department of Justice. Barbara Herman, head of the Attorney General Oil Spill Section in Anchorage, and myself. We generally discussed background of the proceedings which had occurred over the past 2 years, and we decided to proceed jointly with respect to the prosecution of the state and federal claims against Exxon. That was our first meeting. During the next 2 weeks, I began studying the course of the litigation, where it was at the present time, and I developed the distinct impression that for this litigation and the claims against Exxon to be successfully prosecuted, it was necessary that the federal government and the state governments proceed in general jointly against Exxon, because I felt, calling upon my experience as a trial lawyer, that Exxon certainly would prefer to have the state taking one course of action and the federal government taking another course of action, because then it could sort of get the two governments in a crossfire. I also felt that it was absolutely necessary for the federal government to file its civil action against Exxon, or at least get underway to file its civil action against Exxon. You'll recall at that time, the federal government had not filed a complaint against Exxon. One of the reasons I imagine that it had not done so was because of its pending criminal proceedings against Exxon, and did not want to be in the position of compounding the civil case and using it connection in any way with the criminal proceedings. So, you'll recall that the Department of Justice announced their intention on January 15th to file civil action against Exxon. That action, however, was not filed, and a series of negotiating sessions was held between representatives of the Department of Justice and Alaska representatives. Those discussions were initiated, you will recall, by Governor Hickel, who requested a meeting with Larry Rawl, Chief Executive Officer of Exxon Corporation. Mr. Rawl accepted the governor's invitation. There was a brief meeting in Juneau, mid to late January, attended by Mr. Rawl, Lee Raymond and Jack Clark, executives for Exxon, along with the governor, chief of staff, Hodel, and myself. And at that meeting, you will recall, as it had been publicly announced, the governor suggested what he termed as a global settlement of the litigation for $1.2 billion. The governor said at that meeting that we were working jointly with the federal representatives Mr. Rawl said, whom are you meeting with in the federal seat? And the governor said, as I recall, Secretary of the Interior Lujan and the Department of Justice. Mr. Rawl said at the conclusion of the meeting, well, that's fine. Pleased to have been here, and we will think about your proposal. Or words to that effect, as they say. Subsequently, I received a telephone call from Mr. Clark, during which he indicated that the governor's proposal was not meeting with much enthusiasm. And so we then decided that it was necessary, or at least advisable, to unify the state and federal forces, you might say. And so, working toward that end, we set up a meeting in Washington, D.C., attended by federal cabinet members. The purpose of that meeting with Mr. Rawl and Mr. Raymond was to demonstrate to the Exxon representatives that these two governments were both on the same track and that we were proceeding jointly and collectively with respect to the prosecution of the claims against Exxon. Understandably, Exxon, in my view, did not want to be dealing with just one of these governmental units and not the other. I think probably they understood that it would be, as a practical matter, impossible to reach a settlement with one of those two governmental units and not the other. So we, the state government and the federal governments, arranged another meeting with Mr. Rawl and Mr. Raymond in Washington, D.C., to further discuss the governor's global settlement proposal. It was the governor's view and my view, following the receipt of my call from Mr. Clark, that we were going to further the settlement process. We had to, you might say, escalate the process. And so we did that. And probably sometime during the last week in January, we held another meeting in Washington, D.C., this time with Mr. Rawl, Mr. Raymond, the lead federal trustee, Dr. Knaus, and his lawyer, General Counsel of NOAA, Tom Campbell. Bill Riley, the EPA, was there. The Secretary of Commerce Skinner was there, acting in his role as, you might say, head of the Coast Guard. The governor was there. Secretary Lujan was there. I was there. And Alan Rawl, the General Counsel of the Department of the of Agriculture, was there, since the Department of Agriculture has within their jurisdiction the National Forest Service. We had a fine meeting with that group on that occasion.
Mr. Attorney General, I appreciate the detail. I'm not sure it's necessary to go into quite this much detail.
All right, well, let me just follow through a little more since we're getting underway. And at that time, we said about the decision was fundamentally made to continue with settlement negotiations. I mean, because I give that detail because I think that was the critical meeting during which it was decided that we would really get underway in these negotiations. Following that meeting, we held a series of meetings with Exxon representatives and representatives of the various federal agencies who were involved in the oil spill. The negotiations on behalf of Exxon were conducted by Jack Clark, senior attorney, more than attorney, member of the board of directors, etc., and Lou Raymond, the chief operating officer. Lawyers, several lawyers from each of the involved federal agencies were present. Those meetings lasted throughout February and into March. There were a lot of meetings, meetings which required, certainly on my part, patience, which I never thought I possessed, meeting with the federal representative. We would have meetings in which there were three or four or five federal attorneys from each agency present. We have the federal government, myself largely on behalf of the state government. We had to work out what might be termed a joint or unified position to take with respect to the Exxon. Then once we got those positions worked out, we had to go and endeavor to reach accord, negotiate with the Exxon representatives. That process lasted, as we know, about 6 weeks. Biggest issues were, as you might imagine, first, the amount of money Exxon would pay. Secondly, of course, the period over which they would pay it. Another major issue, which developed early, were the provisions for a reopener clause and the maximum amount for which Exxon would be liable under the terms of the reopener clause. Early on, there was discussion about the release of Alyeska, about which I will speak more. And as these days and weeks and almost months went on, we just continued to negotiate issue after issue until about 8:30 in the night in which the agreement was signed. We reached a final accord, signed it later that evening. That's the process.
Okay, I would appreciate it if you would be good enough to, with that background, start, and why don't we discuss first the consent decree with particular attention to the issues that we have outlined. But I see Representative Navarre has a question. Before recognizing him, I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representatives Davidson and Donnelly, members of this committee, and we had Representative Martin here earlier, and I see Representative Carney is in the back. Representative Carney, why don't you just come on up and join us here at the table. Representative Navarre.
Mr. Attorney General, the figure, $1.2 billion or $1.1 billion, whatever, where did that come from again?
That came from the governor.
What did the governor base the 1.2 number on?
I think he had a strong intuitive feeling as about where the settlement ought to come out. I never spoke with him and said, well, Governor, I want to examine you on how you arrived at that number. I accepted the governor's intuitive judgment with respect to the settlement.
Did you, in the course of the settlements, analyze the spill assessment data and numbers that are attributed there and try to determine whether or not 1.2 or 1.1 billion is a figure that's, I guess, a proper settlement figure, given that at the time the governor was talking, the governor intuitively came up with 1.2 billion. Was he thinking along the lines that that would settle the state's share or the federal and state share together? You know,
I believe, and I'm quite certain, that he was thinking about settling the federal claims and the state claims for that figure.
Did he speak with the maybe some of the federal assessment people or anyone with the federal government before he intuitively came up with his number?
Not from my knowledge.
Thank you.
I have myself and then Representative Covina. I note that we've also been joined by Representative Finkelstein here, if we could get him another chair.
Okay.
Okay. With respect to the follow-up of Representative Navarre's question, that figure was offered, and do you know if the figure contemplated any of that would be considered a fine, or was that fine supposed to be in addition to the figure, or do you know if it was included in there, and also the reopener aspect of it? Was that figure intended by the governor to be all at once or to include any reopener, or do you know?
I don't think when the governor mentioned that figure, he thought about provisions for a reopener.
How about the fine?
I'm not certain whether he considered the fine as being within that number or whether he didn't.
Okay.
By that I mean I'm not certain whether he contemplated resolution of the criminal case within that maximum financial figure.
Okay, and the staff suggested the following question. Was there any written or taped record of the negotiations?
No.
Who drafted the final versions of, let me back up a little bit. These documents appear to be fairly similar to other settlements that have been entered into between the federal government and other oil companies concerning other oil spills. Who drafted these particular agreements? Let's start with the CD, the consent decree.
When you use that term, drafted, I don't think it can be said that any single person drafted the document. There was participation in the drafting process by the Department of Justice, by the Department of Law, specifically, largely, Carver Herman, Craig Tillery, Assistant Attorney Generals in the oil spill section, and Joe Donahue. There obviously was some involvement by Exxon lawyers, but the principal scrivener, as we referred to them, was a representative of the Department of Justice. Bill Brighton was his name.
Do you know whether Mr. Brighton?
Yes.
Do you know whether Mr. Brighton used as a model any of these previous settlements?
Don't have actual knowledge because I was not directly involved in that process, but I am reasonably certain that he did. I can't imagine why he wouldn't avail himself of materials which the Department of Justice had used in other clean water actions.
Okay. I have, thank you.
I mean, that's the practice of lawyers. I've done that all my life. I don't like to start from scratch every time I draft a deed of trust, but I can't say for sure that he did.
I understand, and we're certainly not at all being critical of that. We just want the record to reflect the facts.
He's a very able, skilled lawyer, I would say. I was impressed with his skills.
We have next Representative Covina, anybody else? Representative Hudson, Representative Davidson, anyone else in that order?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General, I'm Gene Covina. I represent Prince William Sound where the spill took place. I'm a little kind of an impatient person, so I'm going to put my major concerns right out in front to you if I could. Number one, I'd like to compliment Exxon on their skill in negotiating. I think they negotiated a very good settlement for themselves. Number two, I am very concerned about Prince William Sound being held hostage and that the state of Alaska allowing Prince William Sound and the affected areas to be hostage by your refusal to release the scientific data. Now, I guess as Attorney General, your concern is the state being sued. But as a representative of Prince William Sound, I'm concerned about that area being taken care of, being dealt with, being rehabilitated to the best possible, at the earliest possible, so that the people are not being affected.
If you think that way, then you should immediately vote to approve this settlement.
Well, if you're with that statement in mind, how, if you haven't researched that scientific information, or if you did not use that as a basis for the dollar figure out there, the people, the scientists don't know, the people of the communities don't know, the people of the villages don't know what really is, what the results are of those. How can we vote for it without that information coming to us and being allow us to have that knowledge of what is there? We had some private hearings on that information in a really was, in my opinion, a farce. We didn't get any information in those private hearings that really let us know what the real effects of this bill is to that area. So that's number one of my concern. I mean, putting Exxon and punishing them or how much money we get, you know, I'm concerned that that area is taken care of, and I don't think by keeping secret that we're doing that. I'd like to follow up with Mr. Chairman if I can afterwards, but any other response to that?
Certainly. I mean, do you want me to respond now? I thought that was a question that comes a little later in here, but if you want me to make an exposition of that at this time, I'd be pleased to do that. But I'd like to say that I don't have any recollection of having said publicly or privately that I did not reach an informed decision with respect to whether this settlement is in the best interest of the state of Alaska. I mean, I'm firmly convinced that it is for a number of reasons. And I'm also firmly convinced that it's very much in the best interest of the communities in Prince William Sound that this settlement agreement be approved. So, I mean, as long as we understand each other and we start from that fundamental premise. And it has nothing to do, if I may say so, with whether I release publicly data so it can be used in the prosecution of claims against the state. That's an entirely separate issue. The decision to put my name on this document, in my view, was a very informed decision, represented by nearly 40 years of trial practice in this state. And a lot of thorough reading and research went into it. It was not a cavalier decision on my part. And furthermore, I recognized when I put my name on this document and when I negotiated this document that I was acting as a public trustee for the resources of the state and basically for the public resources in Prince William Sound. And I wanted to see them restored. And I wanted to see your constituents and the other people in the state be able to take advantage of the restoration of those resources before such a long period elapsed that there really wasn't any point in trying to restore them. I mean, I just want you to know that. This wasn't any cavalier decision on my part. And I also want you to know that it represented a lot of intense bargaining with Exxon. Now, you may think I did a bum job. You may think that those skilled, experienced lawyers in the Department of Exxon did a bum job and we didn't negotiate well. That's your view, but I'm prepared to support my view with a lot of sound experience and legal craftsmanship. So long as we get it all right up front.
And that's the way we should do it, right up front.
Fine enough for me. That's why I'm here. And I knew we would do this when I said, put into this agreement, gentlemen, the provision that the Alaska legislature must approve this document. Don't think that I didn't receive a lot of resistance to that. Don't think that there were others who say, keep it out. We don't want the legislature to do it. Sign it under your powers of attorney general. But I said, no, I am not walking away from, you know, $1 billion worth of checks written by Exxon and saying, I made that unilateral decision. I took it on my own hook to do it because I thought at the very least I was obligated as a public trustee and a representative of the state to bring it back to you people and let you people review this and decide yourselves whether it was in the public interest. That's what I did, and that's why I'm here.
If I could follow up just...
You certainly may. I think then, if with committee's approval, Representative Barr has a follow-up right on this point, and I take him out of order. If you, go ahead.
The agreement doesn't say that the legislature gets to approve or disapprove the document. I mean, it does say that, but in fact, whether that language is there or not, the legislature certainly would be able to take a look at the agreement and make our own determination whether or not it's in the best interest of the state. It doesn't allow us any ability to negate the agreement. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean,
it does.
Well, it allows, as the governor has said, that if the legislature does not approve the consent settlement agreement, that the state will not receive with the settlement and will withdraw from. That's clear.
That's not clear in the document.
No, but it's been clearly announced by the government. Governor, I think, and I will reaffirm that now.
Thank you.
We appreciate that, Mr. Attorney General. I'm Representative Kabina.
If we could continue, Mr. Cole, on the scientific information. We're talking about being up front, and I believe many people in the communities and the governments in the communities of affected areas feel like they have been closed out. They've been closed out of the negotiation process. They've been closed out of the results of the scientific data. Could you pursue that point of why you feel so strongly that this is a way for Prince William Sound to be restored when it, myself and I believe many people in my communities and my district don't think that way, that we don't have probably the information that you have in your mind why you think this is the best way to get that, to get that area back into the best condition it, it could be?
I'd be pleased to do that. Should we address that now?
Yes,
Chairman.
I realize that from time to time members may have questions that aren't exactly in the chronological order. We have them in a schematic order. I'd like you, if you're agreeable, to be a little flexible so that we have their questions addressed.
I agree with Representative Covina, but let's get to the basic issues in this settlement. Is it good for the state? Shall we do it? Shall we throw it out? Or shall we proceed with it? That's the basic issue here. And we can talk about the nuances of the agreement and the interpretation of several provisions. But the real issue that you people must address, the legislature must address, is this in the best interest of the state? And I think we should, as Mr. Representative Covina says, address that issue head on. I think it's in the best interest of the state. I want to say preliminarily that whether it's in the best interest of the state or whether it is, does not turn exclusively on the scientific data. Not exclusively. In considerable part it does, but not exclusively. So, with that preliminary comment, I'm now prepared to respond directly to that question, if that's the chairman's wish. Would you like me to do that?
Oh. Yes.
Let me say that I thought about this question over the weekend, and I've tried to formulate my responses in a meaningful fashion. First, we look at where the state was with respect to the prosecution of its claims as of mid-January of 1991. The state had spent, at that time, let us say, 18 months in the prosecution of its claims, which were broadly based claims. Secondly, at that time, the state had spent, say, perhaps $20 million in prosecution of those claims. Perhaps more, perhaps as good a number as we need to have here today. At that time, the federal government had not filed any claims in court against Exxon. So, in some ways, you might say that the state was 20 months, 18, 20 months, perhaps 2 years ahead of the federal government in the prosecution of its civil claim. How long would one think that it would require the state to proceed with the prosecution of its claims was a factor which I considered when I thought about this lawsuit and participated in the negotiating process. I think that it's fair to say that if you look at other similar type litigation, that you could easily be looking at the period of time between 8 and 12 years. How do I say that? What is the basis for that? Well, one, we know the Dinkum Sands litigation with the federal government has been going on for perhaps 13 years. It's not yet resolved. We know the Amoco Cadiz litigation dealing with oil spill off the coast of France is about a similar length of time, 12 or 13 years. And it's just, can't say this for sure, but not far out of the trial court. Maybe 8 months, maybe a year. So I think conservatively one could say before the state's litigation wended its way through the judicial system that we would be looking
that perhaps 6 more years, 8 more years, and maybe as many as 10 more years. Fair evaluation, I think, hard to quarrel with. Maybe someone wants to say, well, 6 years. But bear in mind that by the time that the litigation went through the Superior Court and then up to the Supreme Court, that the likelihood of error in that record is great, because there are so many issues involved in the prosecution of this litigation, and in my view, it's almost impossible for any trial judge to try this case without error. And we also know, don't we, that cases appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court as a guide. I don't know the exact figure, but I know there's a high percentage of them are reversed. And certainly there's a high percentage of reversal in cases in the Alaska Supreme Court, which do not involve issues anywhere near as complex as this, or in an area of the law which is as unsettled as this. So that was a major consideration that I had in mind when I participated in the negotiation of fixed money. That's number one. Number two is, during that period of time, what would be the expense to the state? How much money would the state be shelling out, as it were, appropriating, to use a little more formal term, every year in the prosecution? Well, what does one say? One want to say $12 million a year, $15 million a year? I think as the case got closer to trial, we would be looking at more, perhaps $15 million a year, perhaps more. So multiply that sum times 6 years. What's that? $90 million we're putting into the prosecution of the claim, and we're just getting through 6 years of litigation. That's number one. That is something that I surely thought was worthy of a consideration. If you people are closer to the budgetary constraints, you're closer to how much money is available to spend on litigation. I thought it was certainly a factor, the amount of money which would be required to continue the prosecution of this lawsuit. Next, as I alluded to earlier, the law in this area is wholly unsettled. I mean, there's two or three scattered cases dealing with the Clean Water Act and some of these issues. And so a great many of the issues which would be presented to the judge are what we call issues of first impression. And, you know, who knows what the decision is going to be. They're very difficult decisions, and like I say, there are really few judicial roadmaps or statutory roadmaps as far as that's concerned. Exxon certainly is not the type of litigation which one can economically overpower. It perhaps in some ways is an institutional litigant. It has available resources for litigation. I don't want to say that dwarf those of the state of Alaska, but certainly are comparable. So from the economic standpoint, Exxon is in a financial position, and perhaps in another position to carry on this litigation indefinitely without significant financial So I had those decisions, or those fundamental considerations in mind when I evaluated the litigation. Okay. Now, like I say, I've been doing this for 40 years. I think of one thing I really do in the law, and people say, you know, what do you do, and so forth. You know, it's sort of hard for me to answer what type of practice I have and what type of lawyer I am, because I really don't regard myself as having great skills in the law in any area. But one thing I think I do well is evaluate litigation. Just one thing I think I do well. Maybe I don't try cases very well. Guarantee you I can't draw deeds of trust. Guarantee you I can't draw wills and testamentary trust. But one thing I think I can do is value litigation. And as Casey Stengel used to say, you can look it up. It's one thing I say. So when I evaluated this case, you know, you look at these cases and you say, you know, where do I really think I am, you know, in this lawsuit? And what are the tough issues? What are the obstacles? how much do I really think I can prove, you know? And how vulnerable are our witnesses? And how sure do we really think we are to prevail on these issues? And, you know, you take all these things and you sort of roll them around and, you know, you come up with a sense about what the litigation is worth. It's a subjective process, and it's not a science. It's science. It's an art. And it isn't something that when you take and some economist says, well, you know, gee, look at the damage from the loss of royalties. Well, you know, they're great numbers. But I also know that when you analyze those numbers and when you get into the courtroom, some of those magnificent numbers you see and those magnificent studies you see don't stand up very well. So I took that experience as I evaluated this litigation. Now, let me take it a step farther when you really want to talk about some of the problems.
I would only add here, Attorney General, that I don't want you to think that I didn't want you to settle, because I have felt from the beginning that a settlement is the best way to go. I think it's the terms, some of the terms of the settlement and some of the things that we're now tied into that...
Let me go on a little bit, because I really want to go on, because I want to tell you where I think the real problems in this litigation are. And, you know, sure, one of these people say, well, why don't you get more money? I mean, you know, I remember those days when I used to practice in Fairbanks in the early 60s, you know, and we'd have these clients, these contractors, and, you know, represent them, you know, when they had their divorces, when they had their envoys and things. But when they had really big cases, they went to Seattle, you know, and got the big shot lawyers in Seattle, and, you know, they became sort of the chief counsel for these contractors, you see. And then when we would have these little piddling cases in Fairbanks, the clients would say, well, my Seattle lawyer told me this is what you ought to do, you see. So, you know, finally we small town lawyers in Fairbanks got about half smart and said, well, why don't you have your Seattle lawyers come up and show us how to do it up here? And they did, and they did worse, you see. So we sort of put an end to these people going to Seattle and dealing with other lawyers who said, you know, I could do better and so forth. So I've, you know, been that route, and I know this second guessing is more money. So let me now address that a little bit. How much money did the state really have expected to recover this lawsuit? Let me tell you that the real problem in the case from the state standpoint is what natural resource damage does the state have a right to recover for under the Clean Water Act, or any private common law doctrine of public resource trustee. Separate and apart from those of the federal government, that's a big issue in this case, and it's one that had to be addressed fundamentally by the state before any evaluation of how much the state could be expected to recover. And there are some very major problems. First, the contest for this of recovery the state is entitled to recover. Take, for instance, the sea otters, which we know were damaged. The question then is, can the state recover for damage to the sea otters under the Marine Mammal Protection Act? Mm-hmm. I mean, can the state recover the damage to the sea otters under the Marine Mammal Protection Act? The question, or does that element of recovery lie with the federal government? And there you come to the juncture of this litigation and deciding what to do is how can the state tactically or strategically proceed with its litigation against Exxon without the federal government at its elbow. Because you know what Exxon would say, don't you? Exxon would say, in the course of the litigation, states witnesses on the stand, Exxon says, object to that evidence, that recovery is held by the federal government under the Marine Mammal Protection. Big problem. So it gets back to what I said earlier about how do we proceed. Would the state be required to wait for the federal government to file its action and to catch up? Marine Mammal Protection Act, one problem. And I don't want to say here about the state's conclusion on that issue, but obviously, I think without question, everyone recognizes this is a great legal problem. And one might conclude that the damage to the charismatic sea life could be claimed by the federal government. That's just one of the acts. Then what about damage to or the loss of the eagles? Well, you know, there's the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act adopted by the federal government. Can the state recover for damage to the eagle population there in the face of the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act? Legal issue. Next issue. Can the state recover for damage to the migratory waterfowl under the Migratory Bird Protection Act? Legal problem. Can the state recover under the federal regulations for the animals which are on the National Forest land? Big problem. Let me just read to you some of the federal regulations on the subject, because I want people to understand the problems with which the state is faced in the litigation. Let me read to you what is provided in 40 Code of Federal Regulations 300.605. And this is what it says as you consider Prince William Sound. The Secretary of Commerce shall act as trustee for natural resources managed or protected by the Department of Commerce or by other federal agencies and that are found in or under waters navigable by deep draft vessels, in or under tidally influenced waters, or waters of the contiguous zone, the exclusive economic zone, and the outer continental shelf, and in the upland areas serving as habitat for marine mammals and other protective species. That's a federal regulation promulgated by the Environmental Protection Agency, which one might readily conclude gives those natural resource damage recoveries to the Secretary of Commerce.
Mr. Attorney General, I don't mean to interrupt you. Unfortunately, our committee only has limited time, and we, I think, as Mae West would say, you can quote Casey Stengel, I guess I can quote Mae West, I forget your drift.
Well, let me just throw a couple more out. Because, I mean, one gets under the gun for this, and I wanted me to head on, and I want to give you the next sentence and a couple more. Examples of the Secretary's trusteeship include marine fishery resources and their supporting ecosystems, anadromous fish, certain endangered species and marine mammals, and the National Marine Sanctuaries and Estuary Research Reserves. Now, you know, certainly the state is in a position to take on the federal government and claim that these regulations are wrong and in error. But there is a confrontation there with the federal government. Let me read the next one. Secretary of the Interior. Examples of the Secretary's trusteeship include migratory birds, certain anadromous fish, endangered species, and marine mammals, federally owned minerals, and certain federally managed water resources,
Okay? Just let me add one. So, as one evaluates how much money the state and the prosecution of its own claims could be expected to recover from its litigation, one certainly had to evaluate what elements of recovery it was entitled to receive an instruction from the federal court, enabling the jury to award damages to the state. And if we had gone our own route, we would be faced with Exxon's position in every one of these single elements of recovery, saying those elements of recovery are held by the federal government.
I know you haven't, sir, but does the federal regulation say that we need to keep secret our scientific data and information from the people of Alaska, who is their scientific data? Does it say that we have to, in essence, take the side of someone that we were suing because against the people of our state and against the communities of our country? I don't think any of us are arguing that this wasn't complicated or that you weren't going to have great problems in taking this all the way to court. I think we all recognize that. But I guess I'm trying to get at, more specifically, how do we help the people, the citizens of the state of Alaska, in through this settlement? And I think you're sidetracking me somewhat.
No, I think you want an explanation of why this agreement was entered into, why the governor and I signed our names agreeing to a settlement of $900 million or $950 million, and I'm trying to say somewhat in detail, but I want it understood by people of the process, and I don't want to skip over it as to why I thought and the governor thought this was in the best interest of the state. Now, let me go on and say, if you want to take $900 million of this settlement and take it and use it to restore the damaged resources in Prince William Sound and down the road, as it were. Yes, sir. I haven't forgotten about you. There is $700 million to take and use to restore these damaged resources, and that will be available in the course of the next 10 years. Meanwhile, if we'd gone the litigation route, you see, there would be no money used to restore those resources for which your constituents suffered damage. And the trustees, and by virtue of this settlement, want to take that money and restore the damages which are in literally and figuratively in the backyard of your constituents. That's what the money will be used for, to restore the damage. Now, if we'd have gone and spent 10 years in the litigation process, your constituents would not have $700 million available in the next 10 years to restore the damaged resources which your people have suffered. And that's one of the fundamental points in this entire settlement, that there will be $750 million to use to restore these injured resources. If you want to wait 10 more years and say, now we have some money to restore these resources, which in many respects, hopefully, by the processes of nature, will be naturally restored, and we'll have money. Maybe we'll have more, maybe we'll have less in 10 years from now. But one thing we won't have done is have this money to restore the damage in the interim.
We have a number of additional questions here. We're going to run out of time, and I know you're going to be looking forward to coming back before this meeting tomorrow, but we'd like to get as far as we can.
Yeah, I'll be here whenever you ask me, but I just want to have the opportunity and the privilege, if you will, to give a full explanation of why my name is on that document. Because there are lots of reasons, and I want to say that there's the only information which is being kept from people who want to use it, you know, to invade the state treasury, and that's what I'm endeavoring to protect against, what I intend to protect against, with every resource at my command.
We have Representative Covina, Hudson, Davis, and then Navarre. But Representative Navarre has some.
Maybe we could get some short, succinct.
We have Representative Covina has the floor. We have Representative Hudson.
Mr. Chairman, I just would really like to get on and answer some of these questions. I think there's a, and I really appreciate going through the process, and I think that's really been helpful, but there's a lot of questions about the elements of the settlement here that we don't have the answers to. And I know we got a short period of time in order to do that, so I hope we can get on into it and get some of the answers.
Yes, I want it understood that we will meet as long as necessary and whenever is necessary, and regardless of what other committees are meeting, and get answers to these questions from all of these witnesses. Do you have specific questions or at this point?
No, not at this point.
Okay. I have Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I do appreciate the good course in how to evaluate legislation, because I do think that you should also be given as much time as is necessary to explain, as you have been doing, the reasons for the document and why your name is on it. And thank you for mentioning down the road. I was getting a little worried about that. But there are a few questions that come to mind. Certainly, the explanation that you've given to the federal words there, we are clearly within the federal grasp as far as our resources are concerned. So I was happy to learn that. Not happy to learn that. I learned that.
But let me say, I don't want to say within the federal grasp. I'm simply saying, although the state takes the position and would have taken a position in the litigation, that the state has the ability to recover for those damages. Nevertheless, one must recognize that there are legal issues there which would have to be resolved by courts.
I understand, I think, what you're saying. I guess, you know, when you're looking at it from the perspective of an elected official, and the public perceptions you deal with are many. 0.4% of a company's annual revenues is not a heck of a lot of money, it seems. But at the same time, if we put it all in perspective, maybe it's the best deal we could have gotten. I don't know. But I still have to ask the question, you know, what did my damaged constituents get out of it? And sometimes it seems not much. On the other hand, the initial meeting of the you described regards the intuition. You know, it seems that there are different parts to this that that intuition should have included, and I guess it concerns me that if you started out that level, why wasn't there the part that was the social as well as the resource damage and the economic damage as well? And how about the punitive aspect? You know, then there's what we spent for legal costs and cleanup. Why wasn't that part of that initial intuition?
Are you asking me that?
Yes.
Look, let me say this. We certainly tried to recover $1.2 billion in cash from Exxon. Mm-hmm. Exxon wouldn't agree to pay that amount of money. So we negotiated to get the maximum amount of money under other terms of the agreement, which we were able to negotiate. That's the best we could negotiate. You see, well, it's the art of the possible. And if we had been able to recover $1.2 billion or $2 billion, that would have been fine. But we weren't able to do it. We tried.
Well, in that regard, then, when you started, you didn't start with the legal wheel, but I suspect neither did the corporate legal advisors. Were there apparent, and, you know, I'm not a legal craftsman by any means. We asked the question the other day, who wrote the actual document? We talked about Scribner Brighton. But were there apparent influences as far as the corporate legal perspective that you could identify?
You mean the Exxon people?
Yes.
I probably read that each of these documents myself 30 times, at least, early in the morning, late at night. And I know each of the lawyers from the oil spill section in Anchorage read those documents. And I, you know, cleaned up a lot of the language in there personally, tightened it up, and spent a lot of time. Now, of course, the Exxon people read it. And they would come back to us and they'd say, well, we want to change
paragraph 34 and put the sentence in paragraph 32. And we would talk about that at length. Sometimes we acceded to their request, sometimes we didn't. It's just a negotiated subject. Every word in there, believe
me. Well, I'd like to ask a good question, but I just don't have any right now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sure that we will all have a lot of good questions as we go along. Representative Pickens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate this chance to talk here. My question was just a simple one on the disclosure of the information. I do understand your view. It sounds reasonable, the idea that why should we give out information to someone who's trying to raid the state coffers? But I just wanted to present a different perspective and see if you can see that that too is reasonable. The idea that these people who are involved with it are state residents, that the information involved is not just one side of the information. We did have a confidential briefing by the administration, and in that learned that the information is all over the place. It covers all sides of things. Some of it show damage, some of it show no damage. And that it's only fair play that in a person in challenging the state or the federal government that they have access to it, that these are our people. If we're causing them damage, why is it unreasonable that, and if we can be shown in the court of law that that's the case, why is it unreasonable that we find some way to compensate them for it? And, of course, on the federal level as well, where we aren't even the ones paying. Why shouldn't they be paid for the governments in those cases? I'm not asking you to re-argue, but just isn't there some reasonableness in that position as well?
I'm not sure I follow you, to tell you the truth. The state gets sued virtually every day, sometimes several times a day, and then by its residents. And in the course of defending against those claims, the state spends money, and it generates what we call a work product, expert opinion, legal research. And under the rules of civil procedure, we're entitled to protect certain of those work product materials. And the state does that in every litigation that it is in which it's suing. Now, I see nothing that's different about this lawsuit, other than there are more state residents suing the state than ordinary, which would lead me to say to these people, well, let's not follow the discovery rules of civil procedure and open up the state work product to everyone who wants it. I just see no reason to differentiate this case from the ordinary case. If the legislature wants to say, open the state treasury to 5,000 lawsuits or 10, it just frankly scares me. All I'm saying is that these people want this information to the extent that they're entitled to receive it under the rules of civil procedure, they can have it. To the extent that they're not, we will resist it. And if they dismiss those suits against the state, certainly they will have it to use in the prosecution of their claims against Exxon. That's my position. I remain convinced of it.
Mr. Chairman, not only the rules within the court, we passed legislation last year, Representative Brown's bill on access to information, and my reading of that is that right now, this information should be public. I can't see any basis where state paid for studies shouldn't be public, and I don't, you're more familiar with the legal side, but on the biological side, I don't know many cases where we, this has ever occurred in the past. I think someone could succeed in getting access to that right now, right through the laws we passed last year.
If they can, then they will receive it, won't they?
Well, that's the public policy we're debating here today. We believe in a different side, or some of us, I at least, believe in a different side of that issue. And I just, I'm willing to, recognize the basic logic in yours of protecting the state. I just think there's something in ours that you ought to see it well. These are, there's two sides to all this information. This isn't giving them information that's one-sided. We've already got, on the state level, the things we can use to defend our position. All we're saying is, where there's damning information, where there's something that helps them, that's the truth. They ought to have access to that as well. They're Alaskan people and businesses, and that isn't unreasonable.
I'm not saying your view was unreasonable. I'm simply saying that I've thought about it a lot. I think it's my statutory obligation, you know, under laws that this legislature has passed, to preserve and protect the state's legal rights. And I'm simply following, you know, the law, in my view.
I have a number of questions, and then we'll start with the second round here. And it's my intent, basically, Mr. Attorney General, to go through the major questions in the list, requesting fairly, as we would say in court, short, succinct answers.
You know, to the extent, sir, that it's possible to answer fairly and in well-balanced fashion, succinctly, I would certainly be pleased to do that. But when the questions say, tell me the reasons you agreed to $950 million, I think that I should be allowed to state the reasons, just so the record is clear.
Oh, of course, and that we didn't mean to truncate your answer in any respect. But before we start on the list of questions here, as I understand it, you have agreed to review records to back up the $72 million figure for past state expenses. Am I correct in that statement?
Yes, certainly.
And can we get a report on that?
Yes.
When?
Perhaps by tomorrow. We may have it in adequate fashion now.
We would appreciate your best efforts there. It's my intent, members of the committee, to sort of lead the questioning through this list here, unless committee members have an objection. Representative Hudson, do you want to leap in at this point, or should we?
Well, I just wanted to maybe ask the question, Mr. Attorney General. When the governor initially announced the target price, did you think that that helped or did that hurt the ultimate settlement?
Well, I think it helped the ultimate settlement. I do.
Normally in negotiations, which I've been involved in for many years, we don't publicly release our target goals, and that way we keep going out. But I suppose in this instance, it was more of a settlement in principle, at least on the dollar principle, and that's probably the reason why it's different.
Let me say, you know, a brief word, succinct word, if you will, about my view of settlement negotiations. You know, I think the art of settlement is to present to the adverse party the figure that gets attention but doesn't drive them away from the table. And that easily could have happened here. The governor had kind of come up with a number that was far too high. We would never have sat down at the table. And I think that the number he advanced was a number that got Exxon's attention but did not drive them away.
Mr. Attorney General, do you happen to have the master list of issues?
Yes, I do.
Well, let's pull that out. And what I'm going to do is attempt, and we're going to try to limit this stop at 2 o'clock because we have other members of other committees.
I'm prepared to remain here, come here tonight, tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday. Whenever you request my appearance.
And we will make allowances because these are important issues here. Okay. I'm just going to sort of go through the list here, and some of them are obviously more important than the others, but they are important. Could the state still sue Exxon for violation of state criminal laws?
Yes.
Does it intend to do so, or do you wish to answer
that? No. I mean, I'm answering it does not intend to do so.
How long will it have? What is the statute of limitations?
I don't know, but I've told Exxon that in writing that the state has no intention to sue it criminally.
Would that be binding on this and future administrations?
It's a representation made in good faith. It has my word behind it. If I'm relieved of my position, some other attorney general may want to change the state's representation. I would hope not.
Is that part of the agreement here, part of the underlying consideration, the state's agreement not to sue Scrimley?
It was a representation made by me as Attorney General to Exxon. It never, well, I don't want to elaborate on my answers. I want to get them succinct, and then I will answer yes or no to every question you ask me, which is susceptible to a yes or no answer. It does not intend to sue as long as I'm Attorney General.
Appreciate that.
But let me just say one word. As we sat down to negotiate a billion-dollar settlement, I did not want to say at that moment, by the way, here's an indictment. You know, I mean, I just didn't think that that was sort of in the cards, the way you negotiate settlements. It never occurred to me to do that. But I've answered the question.
On this point, Representative Cabina has a question.
Just curious, Attorney General, when did you give Exxon those assurances? After the settlement was signed?
No, before. In the final days.
On that same point, it appears that, or a timeline point here, it appears from the articles in the newspapers and whatnot that the $1.2 million was really arrived at quite early in the negotiation process. That a number of papers back east was reporting it and the timelines for paying that out. Would you say that's accurate? Or the relatively close to those numbers that you settled on?
Well, let me say this. When I say it's accurate, reasonably so. But obviously, you know, the first issue we addressed is how much money is Exxon willing to pay? There certainly wasn't much point in addressing a lot of collateral issues until you address the fundamental issue. Are they willing to pay a sum of money under terms which would generally be acceptable?
I see. One question, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, is question number three there. The parties represented, I'd refer the members to page three, paragraph 3 of the CD. The parties recognize that the payments called for in this agreement are in addition to those described above. And does that phrase mean that for the purposes of the consent decree or CD, the amounts recovered are not subject to Clean Water Act limitations?
No.
I'm moving to question 5 now. Why are the natural resource damages of the state not separated from the natural resource damages of the federal government?
I've answered that.
Would you again?
Because it was impossible to segregate those resource damages. And the great secret and the unheralded success of this whole agreement is that both governments put into a unitary trust fund their natural resource damages. If we had not been able to reach agreement on that account, we would be litigating for the next 10 years the issue of which government held which right to natural resource damage recovery. And we wanted to avoid that, and we did.
Thank you. By the way, if I pass on from question to question, if members have questions, please just raise your hand. Representative Hudson.
On that same subject, Mr. Attorney General, could you have, or would there have been any basis for, say, municipalities who also have some damages, that, or at least suspected damages, or would they have been possibly could have brought them into the three-way partnership, state, federal, municipal, with Exxon, or would that, or do they have any natural resource damage standings?
That's another very difficult legal question, which they are now free to pursue against Exxon. Those rights were preserved.
In moving ahead to the next page, Mr. Attorney General, and I'm now referring to that portion of the agreement that's entitled definitions. Does the reference to claims under state law mean that the recovery is not entirely under the Clean Water Act?
No.
Would you care to elaborate that? No money.
It does not mean that the recovery is not entirely under the Clean Water Act.
I guess maybe I was too convoluted in my question and got confused by your answer. Does it mean that it is entirely under the Clean Water Act?
Yes. I mean, that's the purpose, to provide a mechanism and a vehicle by which we could unify the natural resource damage claims collectively and deal efficiently with the resulting recoveries.
So all of the recoveries are under the Federal Clean Water Act?
Yes.
Representative Phillips, I may come back to that.
Mr. Attorney General, I guess one of my main questions, and I think you answered it with all the different acts and all the different laws that could have come into play, but would you just please verify, why did the state choose to settle under this particular act, and did you feel it was the most beneficial to the state that the settlement come under this act with the restrictions on that act versus some other act or just general fund money?
Yes.
Okay.
I think you need to be a little more explicit. We appreciate your brevity, but we need additional clarity.
We'll find a middle ground somewhere.
Well, I mean, if you want to ask me the follow-up question of why, when I respond yes or no, I will be pleased to respond, and I will endeavor to do it with balance. Except on that question is, why did you settle for $900? That requires a lengthy answer. But let me say this. The major damage resulting from this oil spill is damage to the natural resources of the area.
This is how you guys got here.
Prince William Sound, Kodiak, down the way. That's the major element of damage. We know that the waters and the mammals, migratory fowl, birds, and wildlife were damaged. Certainly we know the state has some possible claims for lost revenue and lost oil taxes and so forth. But the major elements of damage in this whole tragedy is to natural resources. And we also knew that as a matter of law, Clean Water Act law, and we also knew as a matter of common law that the holders of the right to recover for those damages are the state governments and the federal government. So that's the problem which we have. And then the problem is how to make the maximum recovery to be able to have monies available to restore those damages. And it was my view that the most efficient method was to proceed under the Clean Water Act so we would avoid the problems of this magnificent tussle with the federal government of who owned what rights and put the money in the pot. And, I'm criticized for that, but look what we received. If you think just a little bit about those long answers I gave about the existence of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Eagle Act, the Endangered Species Act, et cetera, et cetera. You would conclude that certainly the federal government has a major right. You have to concede that, I think. And so here we have the federal government agreeing that the state representatives have equal voice in the recovery of those funds and the expenditures of those funds. That's one of the singular successes, in my view, of this entire settlement. We don't have those guys back in Washington, D.C., telling us how we have to spend those funds. We have a veto power over their actions. We who are in Alaska, we who are close to Prince William Sound, we are close to Kodiak, we have that voice, and we can veto any things that we think are not in the best interest of the people. That's why I, and frankly, get on with the restoration process.
Thank you.
Representative Kabina.
Was there any consideration that this was a way of circumventing the Alaska legislature's appropriation process?
I want to say, quote from the bottom of my heart, close quote, no. Look, I want to just add something. Provisions in this agreement that says the legislature must approve this were something that I fought for very hard, to the point of saying, sorry guys, I mean, that's bottom line. You see, it was a desire on the part of the governor and me to bring the legislature into this process and to have the very sort of proceeding which we're having today, say, here it is. So I didn't have the slightest idea to thwart the legislative process. My goal was exactly the opposite. But remember, I mean, there were desires not to have Congress get into this either, by some who they were shall remain nameless.
This will be the last numbered question we will get to today, but I do have one more question on this subject from the staff. Does any other member have any questions? Representative Carney, and then anybody else, and then I'll close with the staff question.
You've talked about the wildlife resources being the area that's most heavily damaged. The area you could attempt to try to...
The natural resources, all of them.
No, right.
Do you have any figures on the financial losses, the estimated financial losses, fishermen and communities in the Sound? Any estimate of what those losses might be?
Yes. But here's the thing. Remember, let me just say this, okay? You see, do the fishermen hold those rights to recovery? Or does the state, and what's the interrelationship between the state's rights of the loss to the fishermen, because the fish are gone, and those of the fishermen? See, that's a very difficult economic or econometric problem. And you know, we have a sense of that.
That's my next, falls into my next part of the question. That is, what potential liability does the state then have to these people, and the extent of the possible loss that the state would incur if you could sue the state for a negligence?
Well,
you have those numbers.
Not entirely, because Exxon may have paid some of those claims themselves, number one, and it's a fervent hope that the state not get into a squabble with the fishermen over that issue, you see. We'd like to avoid that. From a standpoint, not so much of the state, but, I mean, those are the fishermen's rights, and we hope they prosecute them well and successfully.
Representative Carney?
I'll stop at that right now.
May I have Representative Hudson? Go ahead.
Thank you. I think the record ought to reflect, Mr. Attorney General, you can correct me if I'm wrong. We keep talking about the fishermen's complaints or the fishermen's claims against the state of Alaska. In all respects, these are not all Alaskans. We understand now that there's all the fishermen down in Puget Sound, all the native fishermen who claim particular rights under there. And I think there is a big issue as to just exactly how lenient should we be in trying to make certain that every one of them are made whole at the expense of Alaska. So I think we do have I think there's a broader policy issue here than just the Alaskans themselves.
Do you care to respond to that?
Certainly, I would agree.
Okay, you got a question?
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman, just a closing thing. I think
Representative Kabina.
If we're going, if tomorrow is your last day, I'd hope that...
No. We are not meeting tomorrow. The Attorney General is getting the privilege of meeting with the Senate, and I'm sure we can sit in if we wish there. Then on Friday, he is returning to us.
My point is, Mr. Attorney General, is you wanted to settle this suit. A lot of us wanted to see it settled, but a lot of us want to see the whole thing settled. And I'd be interested at some point in hearing how you believe the state can facilitate in helping our local communities and citizens, and also settling the entire issue. And just something for you to think about, sir.
But I can give you a short answer. Dismiss the claims against the state would be the singular, most effective means to do that. Certainly the state does not wish to throw roadblocks into the recoveries of those who are entitled to recover. And certainly, to the extent we want their Alaska residents, we want to help them. And we would if we were free to do that.
Well, we will have plenty of time to deal with that because that appears later in the agreement, and I'd like to keep those choice questions and answers. I have one question more from the staff. Aren't Clean Water Act recoveries limited in terms of so much money per barrel? The question is, aren't they limited to the extent that recovery of $900 million under the Clean Water Act would be legally impossible?
No, because that's A, what we did. B, I suppose technically one could say Exxon waived that limitation.
I would like you to consider that question a little more fully. I know it's coming out of left field. It's an important question. I'm going to re-ask the question at the commencement of our next hearing, and maybe your staff and our staff can get together on that. I'm not intending to put you on the spot with that. With this, it's now 5 minutes after 2:00. The meeting's adjourned.
Okay, sir.